And the court will proceed to the third case, Minor versus Centercorp.
I don't think so.
Mr. Baker.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is James Baker. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of Jane Minor. This case comes to this court from the district court appealing an order granting summary judgment in a case of age and gender discrimination. The district court concluded that Ms. Minor had not established a prima facie claim of either sex or age discrimination in two separate respects. First, it concluded that her complaints did not rise to the level of constituting a materially adverse employment action. And secondly, it concluded that the comparatives she relied upon were not similarly situated to her. I would like initially to speak to the question of whether, at least for purposes of surviving summary judgment, Ms. Minor presented sufficient evidence that the treatment extended to her did constitute a materially adverse employment action. My understanding of the law of this circuit is that there are three ways employer conduct can rise to the level of a materially adverse employment action. And two of them come into play in this case, as I think the evidence is. First way is where the employer engages in conduct, altering the employee's work environment in a way which creates an objective hardship. The second way is where the effect of the employer's conduct affects the employee's pocketbook and has monetary consequences upon her. And in this case, I think both come into play here. The evidence in this case is that sometime in July of 2001, the plaintiff's supervisor directed her to call upon her accounts in a specific manner. The nature of her account coverage requirement was that she had cover all of her accounts in a two-week cycle.
Is there any effort in this record to show how much time that would have taken had she gone about it in the most efficient way possible?
Our view is she did go about it in the most efficient way possible.
Well, that's obviously false. What's in your brief says, let's assume she starts in Springfield, drives one way to Evansville, and then drives back to Springfield, then drives from Springfield to northeastern Iowa and drives back to Springfield, and so on. That's not the most efficient way. The most efficient way is to drive to St. Louis, service the accounts in St. Louis, and then fly from St. Louis to the other destinations. Was there any effort in this record to piece out how much time that would have taken?
No, there wasn't.
There is actually linear programming software. This is one of the classic problems in linear programming. It's called the salesman's tour. Is to figure out the most efficient way for a salesman to cover a given territory. And the only estimate in your brief is kind of the salesman's tour problem on its head. Find the least efficient way to cover a given territory, which is to start in the middle and then go out in spokes to each one of the destinations.
Your Honor, if that's all there was to the account coverage requirement, you may have a point. I think what the court may not be sensitive to is what is required when Ms. Minor went to an account. She was selling a product that was not approved by the FDA for the purposes to which she was to market it. And as a consequence, she couldn't go in and flash brochures and tell the client what it was she was offering. She instead had to spend a great deal of time with the account, not only with the physician, but with the laboratories, with the pharmacies, develop a rapport with the hope that the hospital and hospital staff would ask her what products her company had to treat this particular medical problem, in which case she could provide information.
She's not making cold calls on hospitals she's never seen before. As a closed list of hospitals, surely they have all asked her this question at least once, or she wouldn't be going back.
I think you're assuming something that may not be the case, Judge. And I think
she goes back to hospitals and just stands there uncomfortably saying, ask me something else. Ask me something else. And then after a day goes away, if they haven't asked her the right question, and then comes back again?
I'm not sure I would put it that way. But yes, she does go in.
She was going to hospitals for which she was actually selling this stuff.
She was going to hospitals that were potential markets for this product. They hadn't agreed to accept and use the product. And in order for her to sell the product, she had to be conversant with the method by which the physician treated his patient. She had to watch vascular surgeons perform their processes. She had to talk to the various laboratory people and nurses. She had to talk with the pharmacies about what their protocols were. It was not something where she could go in 10 or 15 minutes and make a call. Now, you make a good point, Judge, and I think that could be a point the defendants can make, but I think that's why we have juries, to wade through those kind of factual nuances and disputes to find out exactly how burdensome it was on the plane.
Well, but we wouldn't want to go to a jury on every time a supervisor upticked or tweaked a territory or the frequency of contact with an account, would we, Mr. Baker?
Absolutely not, Judge. And if this was just a minor, trivial inconvenience, I assure you we wouldn't be here today.
How gross was the change from what it was that would cause a reasonable juror to say that's oppressive as opposed to a managerial decision?
The evidence was that the plaintiff, prior to this account reassignment, worked on average of 55 hours a week. Following the account reassignment, she worked between 70 and 90 hours a week.
The question is whether that's because of the reassignment or because she chose the least efficient possible means of visiting her accounts.
Judge Easterbrook, isn't that something for a jury to decide?
No, it's not. Not unless
I respectfully disagree.
You do an analysis of the means of doing it. And an employer surely is entitled to assume that the employee will not go and deliberately fall on her sword.
I'm not sure what an employer is entitled to assume or not assume. My view is that the plaintiff presented evidence that the working conditions she was under...
But you've already told me that the plaintiff presented no evidence at all trying to estimate the time it would have taken to do this efficiently.
Well, you're presupposing she was doing it inefficiently.
Yes, that's perfectly clear.
I think that's clear in your mind. I think a reasonable jury could disagree with you. And it seems to me that's the function of a jury.
You might have been able to present the outcome of a study of doing it, say, 10 different ways and showing that your client was doing it in what seemed to be a reasonable way, but there was no effort to do that. As I understand it, the only thing in the record is, here's the way I was doing it, stop.
I don't think we're required to do that. I think what we're required to do is to present evidence.
Here's my problem. I can entirely understand the proposition that an employer who makes women work harder for the same bucks as men is engaged in sex discrimination. So if the reassignment of how you visit your accounts makes her work harder than similarly situated men, that's sex discrimination. That leaves the question whether the reassignment did make your client work harder, and that's something on which there needs to be some evidence.
And I think there was evidence that the reassignment did make her work harder.
No, there's evidence that she did spend more hours, but we need evidence that it required her to spend more hours.
I don't think for purposes of getting to a jury, the plaintiff has to prevent a scientific methodology that she used the most efficient.
I'd be satisfied with a back-of-the-envelope methodology. Let me ask you another question.
Sure.
What relief do you want in this case?
Money damages.
For what, concrete?
For lost wages.
How can there be money damages for lost wages when your client is disabled and to go by the statement that she's receiving Social Security disability benefits, unable to work at any job in the economy.
Because four positions, in this case, have tied her disability to the work-related stresses she worked under. She developed atrial fibrillation. Two physicians testified that with a person of her years, that is stress-induced. A clinical therapist testified
This is essentially a tort case, in other words.
Well, Your Honor, it's an age discrimination case where the damages she sustained was the inability to work. If that's a tort case, so be it.
You're essentially asking for damages that would be calculated as if her supervisor had come up and shot her and thus prevented her from working in the future.
That's one way of putting it. It's not how I would put it. But,
mm-hmm. No, it's an understandable theory of damages. I just wanted to know what it was.
Our view of the age discrimination law is that the plaintiff cannot recover compensatory damages for the emotional distress, that sort of thing, but she can recover lost wages attributable to the employer conduct. And in our view, there was plentiful evidence in this record that her physicians attributed the plaintiff's inability to work to the conduct.
Lost wages are a form of compensatory damages.
They're also a form of economic damages under the Age Discrimination Act.
It was fixed in 1991. No, anyway.
I think I've run out of time. Mm-hmm. If the panel has any other questions.
Not at this point. Thank you, Mr. Baker.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Broderick?
May it please the Court. Counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is John Broderick, and I represent the defendant, Appley Centacor Incorporated. Just to touch on a couple of the points that were raised in the argument with the plaintiff's counsel, I think the remedy for the medical damages suffered by plaintiff as a result of job stress is probably workers' compensation statute. And secondly, we argue strenuously that just because her physicians say that she was damaged, that's not necessarily evidence that she was subjected to an adverse employment action. People react to job stress differently. As we argue in our briefs, that would be simply bootstrapping evidence of damages to show liability, and that wouldn't be allowed in other areas of the law to show that, for instance, a physician was negligent.
Is or was the plaintiff covered by an ERISA disability plan for disability caused by work-related stress?
I believe it is an ERISA disability plan. It says she's on long-term disability now.
It becomes even, well, okay.
What this case is essentially about is that the plaintiff is complaining that she was asked to work harder by her supervisor, and this court has held...
Did you make any effort to calculate, if you do the salesman's tour problem, the most efficient way, how long this tour would have taken?
We didn't make a calculation, Your Honor, but common sense told us that flying...
I hate common sense. Common sense is a very bad solution to a linear programming problem.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I think we argued in our brief that it made sense that if she had flown rather than drove to these places, it would have been more efficient.
But did you attempt to do any calculation? That is, look at actual airline schedules, figure out what it would have taken?
No, Your Honor, because she was a salaried employee, and it was up to her discretion to travel the way she preferred, and that is part of the problem with her case. She had discretion to decide how to do her job.
But your premise is that there was an efficient way to do the tour, and she chose an inefficient way. The best way to show that is not common sense, as if airline schedules were any part of common sense, but to actually construct an efficient schedule that would have shown the difference between how she could have done it and how she did do it.
Well, I think our premise actually is that this was up to her. She was a salaried employee. It wasn't up to us to provide her with...
Look, you're just not getting it. If you can construct such a schedule, and there is a big difference between an efficient way of doing it and her way, then whether she did it the efficient way or her way is up to her. If your best effort to construct an efficient schedule comes out her way, then indeed she's got a very strong case. And I don't see how one can resolve that by common sense as opposed to having different possible schedules in front of us that one can look at.
Well, I don't understand that that she would still have a case, even if she would, the amount of hours she was taking would be to travel would still amount to an adverse employment action, since she was simply doing the job she was asked to do, which is a traveling sales representative.
Yes, but her theory is that on account of, and then here insert protected category, she was told to do the tour in a way that management knew was inefficient and would cause her to work harder for the same wages. And if that's true, it's a perfectly good theory of discrimination. The best way to test whether it's true is to have before us her actual schedule and a hypothetical efficient schedule.
I agree, and I believe that that is plaintiff's burden. It's not our burden. And I would also like to add the plaintiff failed to show that the alleged similarity.
No, it's not at all clear to me whose burden it is. You're the person moving for summary judgment.
I believe the time.
Movement has to show that there's no dispute of a material fact. And if you just leave the record with the only estimate in it is hers, maybe we've got a material fact.
I believe that estimate by her is purely subjective. It's an affidavit that was filed in support of her summary
judgment.
It's
not subjective. How many hours it takes to drive from Springfield to Evansville is not subjective. It's actual, how many hours did I spend on the road? She can testify to that from her personal experience. What's interesting is to know is whether that is the most efficient way to do it or a really stupid way to do it.
Well, I also believe, Judge, that she've also failed to show that similarly situated employees failed to what hours they were working at their jobs, so her claim also fails on that point as well. She failed to produce any, she deposed all of the other team members, and she failed to produce evidence of what hours a week they were spending at their jobs to show that she was actually working harder. Also, I think her claim with regard to the hours traveled is also hours doing other things, and we have no detail on the record about what the breakdown of what that is.
How are the expenses handled in this company? When you say she could have flown those options presented. Can she bill any? Could she have a chauffeur? I mean, what are the parameters of expense allowed for the salaried sales advance people, I guess?
Oh, absolutely. They would have been reimbursed. Yes, absolutely. There was no question that there were any limitations on their expense account, that played any part in her decision-making. As to how she traveled. So, yes, all of that would have been reimbursed. There's no dispute in that in the record. I think that this court has held oftentimes, many times, consistently, that it will not become a super personnel department and micromanage disputes between employees and employers, and I think that's what simply this is. This court and the Supreme Court have drawn a line in cases like this to try and prevent cases like this from flooding the courts, which are simply disputes between about work assignments, and that's what this amounts to. Secondly,
what do you say to the point that Ms. Miner makes that the two-week routing is a virtual impossibility, given the nature of the job?
Well, actually, she says she didn't do it. And secondly, I find it hard.
What was your first comment?
I'm sorry. She asserts in the record that she did do the account coverage requirement at a certain period of time. So on one hand, she's saying it's impossible. On the other hand, she does assert that she complied with it. It just was hard to do. There's also evidence in the record, though, that this requirement was placed upon her other team members. That's not disputed. It's in writing.
So those territories were comparable in travel and with the other team members? I mean, the territories are comparable.
The territories, the way the territories were laid out before this manager became her manager. One territory is actually rather larger. Some of the other territories are geographically smaller, but there's no issue in the case at this point that the way the geographic boundaries of the territories were set was it set in a discriminatory manner. Nor is it an issue at this point that the accounts that were selected for her territory were selected in a discriminatory manner. And that is the context of this account coverage requirement. She knew when she took this job she would have interstate travel. That's not disputed. She knew what the boundaries of her territory was, and she played a part in selecting the accounts that were selected in her territory. There's a worksheet that's in the record with her notes. She admits that she has a significant role in picking those accounts, and that's no longer an issue of the case. She's simply complaining that she was asked to go to those accounts with some frequency. The lower court also held that that the plaintiff failed to show a prima facie case because she couldn't show similarly situated employees were treated more favorably. The significant distinguishing factor for plaintiff was her absence from the territory for about a whole quarter of a fiscal year. Plaintiff had a disability, took a short-term disability leave in the first half of the year, and no other team member had a similar absence. Plaintiff tries to cite to a team member who was new and had just started work in March of 2001, and also cites to another female team member whose ranking, sales ranking, had plummeted to last. This court has held that these sort of general similarities and problems is not sufficient to show employees are similarly situated, but that the court must look to the qualitative differences that the employees have. And I think it's obvious that an employee who has no experience in selling these products and who had just started is not similarly situated to a plaintiff who had experience selling these products and had already been in this job for some time. And that is also distinguishable from the employee who's had also been in the territory for some time but simply had poor sales. This characteristic, her absence from the territory, also provided the basis of the legitimate business reasons put forth by Mr. Siciliano for managing her the way he did. He had developed a plan in April of 2001 to get her back in front of her accounts. It's undisputed in the record that plan, that field contact report, was a coaching document. And subsequent to that, the undisputed evidence shows she failed to go visit all of her accounts after this absence, and that's when the account coverage requirement was imposed. And that was simply a remedy for this lack of coverage. Also, like the final word on the reasons why he did what he did is it's undisputed his compensation was tied to plaintiff's productivity. He had an interest in promoting her productivity. She came in with a zero in her ranking. She would have gotten no bonus, and that would have been factored into his bonus. So he had only his only reasons. He was only motivated to help her succeed and not to set her up to fail. I see my time has expired. The court has no questions. I just ask that you affirm the district court.
Thank you. Your time has expired, but we had a fair number of questions. You may have an additional minute.
I'll attempt to use it wisely.
Contrary to counsel's suggestion, it is disputed concerning whether the account coverage requirements were imposed upon the other team members. Mr. Siciliano was deposed. Each of the other team members was deposed. They all said the plaintiff was the only one that was treated this way, this account coverage requirement. And Mr. Siciliano acknowledged that and said it was a coaching tool. So at the very best, there is a clear dispute of fact as to whether she was treated the same way as everyone else is. And that seemed to be one of the factors Judge Mills relied upon in determining there was no adverse employment action because of the territorial assignment. The problem is
if your position is that every time a woman or an older worker is given more work than someone else, that's a prima facie case of discrimination, there'll be a real litigation explosion. Because, of course, in these jobs, they're not fungible jobs, so one person will be given additional territory and gripe about it, it's too much work, and so on. That must happen all the time.
I suspect it does, and I think this court has answered that problem, Your Honor. This court says that in order for an adverse employment action to arise, the hardship can't be subjective. It can't be the employee's complaints about a mere inconvenience or not getting the job or assignment they wanted, but it instead has to be an objective hardship, a hardship that a reasonable person would feel. Now in this case, the product manager of Redovace, when informed what the plaintiff's account coverage requirement would be, characterized it as unreasonable and ridiculous. I think that it's a fair question for a jury in this situation, based upon these facts, to make that particular assessment. I don't know how much more time that the court will indulge.
You can conclude your thought. Your time had expired.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Baker. Thank you, Mr. Broderick. all counsel. Case taken under advisement.